The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to the September 5th, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes under College Radio. You can find us on Barbara's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads as well as past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We are all there. I am your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm incredibly lucky to be joined by the entire hour by Caitlin Rother. New York Times bestselling author Caitlin has written and co-authored 8 books of fiction and nonfiction, including Dead Reckoning, Poisoned Love, Body Parts, Twisted Triangle, Deadly Devotion, Naked Addiction, and My Life Deleted. A Pulitzer-nominated investigative journalist, Caitlin worked nearly 20 years for daily newspapers and has made dozens of TV and radio appearances as a crime expert. She speaks to professional groups, works as an editorial consultant and book doctor, and teaches narrative nonfiction, journalism, and creative writing at UCSD Extension in San Diego, where she lives. She draws from her years of experience reporting on a wide range of topics, from addiction, suicide, mental illness, and murder to politics and corruption in City Hall and Congress. Her latest book, Lost Girls, chronicles the story behind the rape and murder of 2 innocent teenagers, Chelsea King and Amber Dubois, bisexual predator John Gardner. It's published by Kensington Pinnacle. It came out July of this year, I think, and it's my huge pleasure to welcome her. Caitlin, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on this morning.
Thanks for coming on. I don't read enough true crime, and now I know why it terrified me. So I'm going to let you first take us into the book, tell us a little bit about this story, and, you know, we all live in Southern California here, not far from San Diego, so I think a lot of people are familiar with this this case from the news, but tell us a little bit sort of about the arc of the story and ultimately how you decided to take it on and write about it.
Well, this happened in my community, and I had left the newspaper where I used to cover events like this, but as an author, you know, I often write about cases that are not happening in my own town, so I don't experience it in the same way. But you know, Amber Dubois went missing up in Escondido in the northern part of San Diego County. And I saw it in the news, but I wasn't all that close to it because it was, you know, San Diego is so geographically, you know, spread out across in these different regions. I noticed she was gone, 14-year-old girl on her way to school, disappeared. And they were looking for her, and her parents were very active. They were in the media a lot. You know, please don't forget our daughter. You know, we know she's out there somewhere. And about a year later, I was going to the gym in Mission Valley, and I saw a flyer for a young blonde girl, and I thought, well, this is different. I never see flyers for missing teenagers. This must be a special girl, because, I mean, you see Alzheimer's patients, you know, the helicopters roam around, but other than that, you don't really hear about it in San Diego.
Yeah.
So I started realizing that this search for this girl was really becoming a pretty big thing for people in San Diego, and it was getting talked about, it was in the news, it was on Facebook, and it went viral, and everybody was looking for Chelsea King. She was a 17-year-old senior from the Poway High School. And the more that everyone heard about her, the more everybody kind of got emotionally involved in this search for this girl. And I've never seen anything like this. The newspapers and the TV were covering this case like no case I've ever seen like it. And, you know, three stories in the newspaper every day, not just one, but three on the front page every day, the top of the news on every channel for 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, it was crazy. And so I thought, wow, look at the emotion here. And they found a pair of underwear that were Chelsea's, and they were able to link some DNA on the underwear to this sexual predator, John Gardner, who had been in prison for 5 years for molesting and attacking his 13-year-old neighbor. So he was arrested before they had even found Chelsea's body. A couple days later, they found Chelsea's body, and then 4 days after that, an anonymous tip, quote-unquote, led them to the remains of Amber Dubois. So this all happened within about a week, and it was like boom, boom, boom. And I, you know, the emotions initially were hope and support for, you know, really hoping to find this Chelsea King. And then, you know, people were so upset and disappointed when they found her body. And then anger at John Gardner. I mean, it was just the most unbelievable spectrum of emotion. And I got caught up with it and in it. And I thought, you know, this really seems like an opportunity. We don't know, as a society, we don't know much about sexual predators because we think that the idea of them is so repulsive that we don't want to know. I think that's the natural reaction for people, to kind of push that away and say, I don't even want to know, just lock them up and put them away. I don't want to see them. I don't want them in my neighborhood. I don't want them around my kids, obviously. But I don't think people understand what makes a sexual predator, including me. So I saw this as an opportunity for education. Maybe there's something that, you know, we could highlight that would be able to prevent tragedies like this from happening again. So that's the long answer.
Do you, that's a great long answer.
Thanks.
Do you have a sense, having written, you know, you haven't written a lot about men like John Gardner in particular, I suppose, but you've written a lot about bad guys.
Yeah, I try with each book, I try to look at something different. I mean, because, I mean, I have to sit with these books in my head for, you know, over a year, depending on how long I work on it. Dead Reckoning, I spent 5 years working on that book. That's up in Orange County with the couple that were convicted of killing Tom and Jackie Hawks by tying them to the anchor and throwing them overboard. He was, Skylar DeLeon, from Long Beach, and this happened in Newport Beach. He was another kind of a predator, but he was, and it had a sexual aspect to it. You know, I had a Wayne Adam Ford was also a serial rapist and serial killer, and he had a whole other list of mental problems. So each time I take a book, I try to look for something different, and I'm currently working on one, the Nanette Packard and Eric Naposky case. They have been just recently sentenced for killing Bill McLaughlin in Newport Beach. And that one actually doesn't have any mental illness other than, you know, killers are not normal people, obviously, but they've got to have something mentally wrong, but there's no diagnosis in this case. So I'm looking for, you know, something different and a different way to explore what makes people into these killers and why do they do what they do and how do they get that way? Is there anything we can learn from this? And is there anything, are there lessons in each of these books that can help us protect ourselves?
Yeah, tell us what did you take out of Lost Girls? Does it change the way that you would advise your kids? Does it change the way you live your own life? Like, what were your takeaways from these murders?
It's made me much more paranoid.
Yeah,
I mean,
me too.
And I don't mean that we should all live in fear, because I'm actually trying to do the opposite in my life in general, but I do think that these stories are important so that we don't just look at people and take them at face value. For example, you should be looking for red flags. Don't put yourself into harm's way. Don't some of the basic things that we already know but don't pay attention to as much. You know, as a woman, don't go walking alone. Don't go hiking alone. Don't go on these trails by yourself. I mean, even when I was up doing the research for this book, I can't even tell you how creeped out I was just trying to retrace Chelsea King's steps on those trails, because it was a very desolate and isolated area. It's a community park, but it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see anyone around you anywhere. And I was so freaked out, I thought someone was going to jump out of the chaparral. And it was really freaky.
Yeah.
I had to leave. I said, I can't be here alone. I felt just that it was just, I don't know if it was because I knew about what had happened there. I'm sure that was part of it.
That couldn't help, yeah.
Yeah, but I right. just felt like, you know, this doesn't feel safe here.
Right, right.
So you have to pay attention to that. You know, don't wear iPod earbuds when you're running, you know, because someone could just grab you. You don't hear them behind you. You know, this, I think there's a lot you can take away from these stories.
Yeah. I wonder if your impression is that life really is more dangerous nowadays, I don't know, with the saturation of you know, available porn on the internet that these guys can access, or yeah. now they can talk to each other and yeah. give each other pointers and tips,
yeah.
or if we just hear about it more because, you know, the media hypes these stories more than they did 50 years ago.
Well, that's always the question. I mean, when I was a reporter, that was something that I dealt with in so many different issues. You know, is something happening more? Is it just being reported more? But I think you raised some good points about the internet and about, you know, porn on the internet and how easy it is to get, and it's addictive for some of these people. I mean, think about how you check your own email and how addictive that is. I read an article that basically explained that I guess it's a dopamine thing where it's like you're getting some kind of pleasure out of doing things repeatedly. So think about it when you're a sick person like this who has access to it. You can just sit in your house and use the computer and get sicker, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's
frightening. That's frightening.
Right. So this story happened in your own backyard, but let's talk a little bit about, before we get deeper into this one, because I do mm-hmm. want to get deeper into this one, but
sure.
choosing subject matter in general, the Hawk case up here in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, for the eight books, how you chose these cases in particular to go deep into. I know everyone has its own story, but...
Yeah, I mean, I guess something just has to really grab me, and I think about what interests me, and I think about what I see interesting other people. So, I mean, I need to, like I said, I have to be able to live with a story in my head, and I have to be able to find that there's something, you know, worthwhile. There's some kind of underlying issue that I think people can learn from, because I know that there are people out there who believe that people who write true crime books are bad people. I have been accused of that with this book in particular, which to me, you know, it seems like they just don't understand, or they don't want to believe that I really do have good motives in trying to educate people. But I became a journalist first, where, you know, we don't go into journalism to make money. We go into journalism because we feel it in our gut and in our heart that we want to change things, and we want to reveal things that are wrong with our society, things that can be changed. I mean, that's an idealism that I came into journalism with, and I actually feel even stronger now because of the way that newspapers have shrunk so much, and the content, and, you know, so many good journalists have been laid off and taken buyouts. I mean, I could go off on a whole tangent on journalism, but books, to me, are really the best place now to get good journalism, in-depth, comprehensive stories where you get all the context and you get all the information. And I feel better today doing what I do as a journalist author than I did sometimes at the newspaper, because there just wasn't enough room to go into these in-depth issues. So I'm looking in with each book for something new that I can look at, and I have some favorite issues, if you want to look at it that way, mm-hmm. and where I've become somewhat of a specialist, and that's, you know, addiction and mental illness, and materialism and greed, for some reason, really seem to hit home with me. I grew up in La Jolla, California,
right.
where everyone around me had money, and, you know, I grew up in a family where my parents worked in a university, and, you know, we didn't have much money, but I grew up around people who did and saw how it could corrupt people. So I find that interesting, too, which is what drew me to the Nanette Packard case. The Skylar DeLeon case, you know, one of his primary motives in killing Tom and Jackie Hawks was greed, and then another primary motive was he wanted to get money to go pay for a sex operation. Now, to me, anything, when you have a psychosexual killer, that, to me, is interesting. It's like, what? How does that brain get like that? You know, because I just don't get it. You know, I don't get it, and I want to understand it, and I think that's how a lot of people feel, and that's what makes people pick up my books. So I look for books where I can really delve into something. You know, why would people turn to do something like this to another person, and what can we get out of it? So Poison Love was about addiction. You know, choosing methamphetamine over, you know, love for methamphetamine for her husband and over her lover who she was in love with. Body Parts, you know, that was a very dark book. That one was even more dark, I think, than this one, because of so many of the victims were less sympathetic than two teenage girls would be. They were troubled, you know, prostitutes and drug addicts that he was, you know, pulling up his truck and picking them up, and they thought they were turning a trick, and next thing you know, he just got, you know, violent with them and tortured them, and that was a very difficult book to write. But he had a really bad head injury, and he spent some time in Orange County, too, so that's another book that actually took place. He was married twice and worked in Orange County for about 7 years, worked at the Marine base.
Yeah, it's very heartening how many of these guys are in our backyard.
I know. Well, and he was a trucker, too, so he was driving up and down California. So, you know, what I've just learned from these books is you cannot tell. Skylar De Leon, I went to go visit him 4 times in the Santa Ana jail. He sang to me. He was charming. Mm-hmm. He had this really high voice, very non-threatening. He seemed effeminate. And, you know, he killed 3 people. Mm-hmm. He slashed one guy's throat, you know, and didn't think a thing of it.
That was the lucky guy.
That was the, well, I guess because it was fast, right? Is that
right.
What you mean?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, it's different with every book, but it's usually, I've got to have, like, some bells that ring in my head. Like, it's got to hit a number of certain points in me to say, yes, this has met the threshold.
Right. And is there any competition over stories between other true crime journalists or writers?
Yeah. Lost Girls is, I think, my first book where I was the only book. I mean, most of my other books, there's already been another book out on the same case. So what I have to do is I have to go much further and much deeper than whoever gets there first. And what generally happens is it's a different publisher who publishes before the trials. And my books always come out after the trials. And in some of these cases, there's more than one trial. So I have to go. Dead Reckoning, I went to 3 trials up in Orange County to commute, you know, over a period of 4 years, and took another year to write it. Lost Girls, there wasn't a trial, and I thought, wow, this will be much easier, but it turned out not to be, because all the documents that I would normally have access to through the court process were not released.
Really?
So I had to really get creative with my research and get documents other ways.
Right,
so.
Right. And it really surprises me how much access these people give you to their lives, that John Gardner was so cooperative as he was, that all of your perpetrators were so cooperative as they are, that his family, you know, seemed like they really opened up to you. And I'm curious about working...
It takes a tremendous amount of work to get that, just so you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about, how you do that.
Well, I'll tell you, in the case of John Gardner, the way I approached that was this. Like I said, with newspapers and TV, you know, you get sound bites. And with the smaller formats with newspapers, the pages are narrower, the stories are shorter. You know, people really get a short shrift. And, I mean, I've been in the media, and I know what it's like to be covered. And, you know, it's not fun. I mean, if I wanted my story told, I don't think I'd want to tell it to the newspaper unless I had to.
Right.
Because it's just chopped up. You know, things are taken out of context. And it's just the way it is. So I appealed to the Gardner families. You know, they wanted to see something good come out of this, if that was any way possible. And frankly, that's what John Gardner told me as well, and told his mother, and that's why they agreed to do it, that they were going to try, you know, to help. Uh-huh. And I know that sounds strange, but, I mean, John Gardner is medicated now. His mother says, you know, I finally have my John back, that I, you know, he was gone, and I couldn't reach him because he was unmedicated and he was, you know, acting crazy and he did these horrible things. And, you know, he's in prison for the rest of his life and he knows he is where he needs to be. But he, you know, I think he wanted to see if he could, this is my personal opinion, he didn't tell me this, but I think he thought maybe this would help his public image.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's necessarily the case, but
right.
His mother was hoping that maybe, you know, something in here could help other people. And by the time, you know, before the book came out, she was so disheartened by everything, I think she didn't think anything good could come out of it. But I kept at it, and I kept telling her, no, I really do believe that, or I wouldn't have done this book. Mm-hmm. I really do feel like when we cast a spotlight on these flaws in the system and how it broke down and how so many things could have been done differently, could have saved these girls' lives, and hopefully people will take a look at this and try to change some things that will save other girls' lives in the future. And that's how I got them to open up. And because I had so much background in covering methamphetamine addiction in particular, which, you know, he had issues with, and mental illness, and his mother was a psychiatric nurse,
mm-hmm.
that appealed to them as well. So, I mean, I know this topic, even though I don't know specifically sexual predators. You know, I told them I was the right person to do this book, and I persuaded them to open up.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Caitlin Rother. The book is Lost Girls. You have such a feeling of, you know, I had a huge feeling of empathy for John Gardner, and, you know, obviously giving us access to his childhood, the abuse he went through as a kid, mm-hmm. both sides of his family being, you know, totally screwed up in a variety of ways. You know, his mom feeling such tremendous guilt. And I suppose that's your journalistic style coming out, or, you know, just having to take a neutral stance towards these predators and men.
Right.
But tell me about sort of living in his head and that process of empathy, and kind of what that does to you as writer and as woman. Was it hard to be empathetic towards him while knowing what he did, and kind of that process of being very fair with him?
I guess I don't really look at it as being empathetic. I look at it more as being objective and not taking sides, and just really, because to me there are three sets of victims here, and I don't, you know, a lot of people would disagree with me, but I think his family has been victimized as well by all of this, because they lost their child also, and people don't want to see that. People say, well, there were murder victims, and a lot of people blamed his mother for not turning him in, and I don't approach it that way. I look at it as, you know, this is not a black and white case. None of these stories are. Mm-hmm. And that the murderers' families, you know, they're going through a horribly rough time as well. So I just try to approach everyone with respect and with dignity. And I mean, and I don't, you know, I didn't confront John Gardner. I didn't, you know, try to say, oh, you're lying about this. You know, I tell my journalism students, they wanted to know, well, don't you call them on these lies? And I'm like, yeah, but I don't approach it that way. Mm. Because if you do, they're not going to talk to you.
Right.
And if my goal is to get information, I mean, I'm not his friend. And I told him straight out, I told his mother straight out, look, I am not going to write a sympathetic book about your son, and you need to understand that. And there are going to be a lot of people who are not sympathetic towards you, so I'm just going to tell the truth. I'm going to tell your story, and I'm going to tell it straight, and I'm going to be fair to everyone and thorough, and that's what I can promise. Okay. So I can't, I guess I just have to feel, I don't want to say empathy, because I don't want people to think that I'm sympathizing with him, because I'm not, but I do think that, you know, the system failed him, and in turn, by failing him, failed those girls.
Right.
So that's kind of how I look at it.
Right. I always have this question about whether killers are born or made, and maybe it's different. It sounds like it's different for each individual case, but I came away with this still not knowing. You know, I was like, I don't know if there was a genetic component. There was such horrible violence and incest and whatever there was in his
right.
family. But certainly there were a lot of contributing factors to how he grew up and obvious turning points. It sounds like his first stint in prison did him no favors.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know if you came away with an impression of whether this was an inevitable thing based on genetics, or whether he really was created, and whether the system itself actually created him in the 5 years that it sounds like that was a real turning point for him, going from, you know, relative nonviolence to something switched on there.
My short answer to all of that is yes.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a topic that comes up with every book I write. And in fact, that's one of my favorite questions to ask prosecutors and detectives. And they always say, oh, no, he had a choice, or she had a choice.
Right.
And that's how it's played out in the courtroom. The defense always says, you know, this is not, if it's a death penalty case where they get to argue the mitigating circumstances, there were things that happened that, you know, mitigate what he actually did. There's reasons why in his childhood he was abused, or this or that, right?
Right.
And the prosecutors always say no, that he had a choice. You know, he had brothers and sisters, and they went through some similar things, and they didn't turn out like this, and there are many people who are abused and tortured, and they don't go kill people. So, I mean, I've looked at that with most every book I've done, and in this case, I mean, I think he came into a pretty dysfunctional family. So he started off, you know, with the social and environmental factors that would predispose anybody to having issues. And there's a concept called resilience where, you know, yes, there are brothers and sisters who were in the same situation, and some of them came out fine, and some of them didn't. And it's not just a question of what's around you. It's not just a question of genetics. It's a question of, you know, some kind of character, personality flaw, or maybe a chemical imbalance. You know, in addition to everything else, he turned out differently, and he was not able to, you know, be stable. He was not able to control himself. And he, you know, suffered from bipolar disorder. He had ADHD. He had some impulse problems. In addition to, you know, then complicating that by using methamphetamine, even he admitted to me, I'm like, that was not a good idea. You know, that just escalated everything even more. And then, you know, he was trying to get on some medication to stabilize himself. He knew that things were bad, and his mother did too, and they tried to get him institutionalized, and the doctor said, no, you know, qualify as a 5150, which means you're a danger to yourself or others, I guess at this moment, and sent him on his way with some pills. Well, those pills exacerbated the mental instability to the point where he was manic, and, you know, pacing around and not sleeping, and, you know, it was a whole mixture of things. Plus, he was angry, and he wasn't able to control his anger, and he had a lot of problems with anger for much of his life. So it's the perfect storm, as it were, of all of these factors, some of them genetic, some of them social, and some of them, you know, just, you know, chemical imbalances and the resilience factor.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Caitlin Rother. The book is Lost Girls. Why don't you, if you can read to us for a few minutes, then we'll take an incredibly short break and come back and talk about craft and writing issues.
Okay, great. I'm just going to start with chapter one at the very beginning of the book. And so here we go. It's opening up in the area where I was talking about, where I actually went up to the trails and looked around. It's in Rancho Bernardo. John Gardner's mother was worried. The bipolar mood swings, erratic behavior, and suicidal impulses that had periodically plagued her 30-year-old son since he was a child were not only back, but worse than she'd ever seen them. When Kathy Osborne left her condo for her psychiatric nursing job the morning of February 25, 2010, John was asleep on the futon in her home office where he stayed when he visited. Kathy called his cell phone and texted him numerous times throughout the day to see how he was doing, but she got no response. When he didn't answer his phone, something was usually up. That evening after work, John was still missing in action, so she decided to combine her usual run with a search for her wayward son, an unemployed electrician and unmarried father of twin sons. Having completed 15 full marathons, as well as 15 half marathons, Kathy routinely jogged 5 to 7 miles around Lake Hodges in nearby Rancho Bernardo Community Park. But she was so worried about John and his well-being that she didn't really feel like doing the full route. She jogged about a mile through the neighborhood, turned at the white railing off Duenda Road. Sorry, let me grab some water.
Yeah, no worries. Hazards of radio. I do that all the time.
Of course, I have to do that as soon as I start reading, right?
No, it's always.
She jogged about a mile through the neighborhood, turned at the white railing off Duenda Road, and started down the narrow path that widened as it left the residential area and fed into the vast, beautiful open space of the San Dieguito River Valley. Depending on the time of day, sometimes she couldn't see another soul for miles in any direction. It was so peaceful out there, far away from the stresses of the city. So isolated, so still, and so deadly quiet. But her nerves were on edge that evening as she ran along the sandy trail at dusk. She jerked to an abrupt halt, startled to see a snake off to the right. Once she realized it had no head and posed no danger, she continued heading toward the slate blue of the lake up ahead, hoping to find John in one of his usual haunts. He told her that he liked to sit on the bench-like boulders that were positioned along the trails, posted with informational placards about the Kumeyaay Indians and the natural wildlife habitat. Knowing his two favorites overlooked a waterfall in the lake, she kept her eyes peeled for discarded beer cans and cigarette butts, but she saw no sign of him. This is the wrong spot, or he's been here and he's just not drinking beer or smoking cigarettes, she thought. Kathy had spent nearly 3 decades managing her son's medical and psychological treatment, ferrying him to countless doctors and therapists who had prescribed more than a dozen medications. Starting at age 4, John had begun with Ritalin for his attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. As he grew older, his behavioral problems became more complicated. As a teenager, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, but he had experienced so many side effects to the drugs that he'd stopped taking them in high school. He had been on and off them ever since, mostly off. John also had a history of psychiatric hospitalizations, and by now, Kathy was very familiar with the danger signs that he was reaching a crisis point. In the last couple of months, he had totaled 2 cars, running one into a pole and the other into a cement barrier. So on February 8th, she had driven him to the walk-in psychiatric clinic at the county hospital in Riverside, where both of them hoped he would be admitted as an inpatient. But even after John told the psychiatrist he might qualify as a 5150, someone who was in danger of hurting himself or others, the doctor said he didn't think such treatment was necessary. He simply gave John some more pills and sent him on his way. 5 days later, John went on a suicidal binge of methamphetamine and other illicit drugs, which landed him in the emergency room. All of this made for a complicatedly close relationship between John and his mother. Things had escalated recently after he'd started using methamphetamine and increasing his drinking. The crazier he acted, the crazier Kathy's own emotional roller coaster became. If she didn't watch over him, she feared he would go right back to the same druggy friends he partied with during his nearly fatal binge, a pattern she'd seen over the past 18 months. Or, worse yet, he'd be successful and actually kill himself. I'm going to stop there.
That was Caitlin Rother reading from her latest Lost Girls. We're going to take an incredibly short break. Please stay with us. Caitlin is going to be here for the entire hour. We're going to talk craft and process in the second half hour, so please stay with us. We'll be right back.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI, Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Again, you can visit iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. Again, for direct downloads of this show, other shows, information on past shows, who's coming up, speaker series events, and more. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and we are here all hour with Caitlin Rother. She is the author, most recently, of Lost Girls. She's the author of 8 novels of fiction and nonfiction, or 8 books of fiction and nonfiction. You can find Caitlin at Caitlin Rother, CAITLINROTHER.com. You can follow her on Twitter and Facebook, and she can tell you more about how to find her later on in the hour. So welcome back, Caitlin.
Thanks.
So let's talk about how far you need to get into a project, what you need to know about the project in order to know that this is going to gel as a full book, how many interviews you need to conduct with the people involved and how much access they're going to give you before you know you're going to be able to turn this into a book.
Well, it really varies with each case, but I do, really most of the interviews that I do initially are to find out whether people are going to be cooperative.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I follow cases in the news sometimes. I'll go to hearings, I'll meet people, essentially. I'll go to, say, a preliminary hearing, and I'll hear the prosecution give a basic outline of the case. Or before that, you know, I'll read some news stories. But I have to call the principal people, the key characters, the key players in the case, to make sure that I'm going to have enough information to be able to do a good, you know, thorough job on a case. It also, I have to go way beyond what's in the news, because otherwise people will just say, oh, I already know all this.
Right.
And people tend to have the tendency to do that anyway. So I want them to know when they read the first few pages that, oh, wow, I didn't know any of this. I thought I knew everything.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So in the case of Lost Girls, for example, I think the main thing that people wanted to know is, what did his mother know? What was his mother's story?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I started. If I could get his mother to talk to me, because she had not talked to anyone else, and to this day she hasn't talked to anyone else, then I have something exclusive, and I have something that everyone wants to know. And it also, you know, by talking with her and gaining her trust, she opened up doors to all these other people. I was able to get in touch with ex-girlfriends and, you know, who she'd stayed in touch with, and the attorneys and, you know, the various law enforcement agencies. And, you know, this book was a very, very, very difficult book to write in terms of access and sensitivity, because of how emotional it was and because it was local and because it was so fresh. And the victim's parents, you know, did not want to participate in that. So I still have to tell their stories as much as I can through the public domain, and I have to make sure I can do that fairly and thoroughly as well, because, you know, I cannot write a book without writing about the victims, obviously, and the victims' families, because that's why we write these books.
Right. Yeah, so. These are, the case is really relatively new, I would think. I mean, these people are obviously, I mean, they'll grieve for a lifetime, but they're really in the early stages of grief still.
Right, so. Right. And so, and then in the writing of it, I tried to be incredibly sensitive about what I included and what I did not include, how I worded things, you know, what I felt that we really needed to know was different in this book about the victims and how they died. I really did not go into that at all out of respect to the victims' families, because,
right.
I mean, I don't know that, you know, either one of the families is going to read this book. One of the victims' family's mother said she did read it. I'm not sure she finished it, but, you know, it's got to be really difficult for them to read. And I can't write a book for two or three people, but at the same time, I also, you know, I'm not trying to re-victimize them and re-traumatize them. And so I did try to really be careful about what I put in. You know, for the conversation I had with John Gardner in prison, we talked for 5 hours, and there were things he told me, and I really weighed back and forth, should I put this in? Does this really need to go into the book? Is this too far? Is this too much? And I work at home alone, and I call people up who I used to work with at the newspaper, and I say, hey, can I run this by you? I really just need an objective, you know, another journalist to tell me, do you think people really need to know this, or is this too much? So I did that in several cases, and they said, no, absolutely, we have to know this.
Right.
Everyone, yeah, we need to know it. Yes, it's going to be difficult, but that's important for us to know.
So. Right. And, you know, I mean, you're put in the position of the difficult position of you've got the ultimate unreliable narrators time and time again. You know, I assume that everybody has their own incredibly emotional take on things, even if in their own mind they think they're telling you the truth.
Right.
Nothing can be more colored by emotion than something like this.
Right.
And so I assume that you have to go back through and verify stories as much as you possibly can. It's amazing you got this book out as fast as you did.
Oh, thanks. Well, I am very, very thorough. I over-report. I probably get paid about a nickel an hour by the time I'm done with these books. But I just feel it's important to be accurate. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to be... to have the most credible and legitimate version of the truth. And, you know, I think that's a whole other discussion. What is truth? Well,
right.
Everybody has their own version of the truth. And I can't tell you that your perception of truth and reality is wrong. It's your perception. So that's how I look at people when they tell me their stories. And that's why, you know, it's called the third person, you know, intimate point of view, right, where I'm going into somebody's head. But it's clear that it's from their perspective.
Mm.
It's not necessarily the omniscient point of view, which, you know, is more my voice and more how I want to paint a picture. I oftentimes will go into the third person intimate so that it's clear that it is that person's perception who is, you know, for that scene.
Right.
And so that way, you know, I do cross-check when there are things that they're talking about that are, you know, factual or not factual in a larger sense. But if it's their own perception, you know, it is what it is. So I will cross-check with as many public sources as I can. You know, Google's wonderful for that, but I do use documents as much as I can and transcripts and, you know, talk to law enforcement and try to find the most credible version of what happened and cross-check them so that it's as accurate as it possibly can be.
Yeah, and you were incredibly good in this when you couldn't verify something of kind of saying, you know, I looked for these phone reports that just happened not to be there, but this is what they told me. And the other thing I was curious about was you've got some great photographs in here, and you said something about how difficult it was to get access to information, photos.
Yes.
Were most of those photos provided by family members, or were those court documents, or how did you get access to all of the
pictures?
None
of the above. I had no, like I said, the families did not participate in this book, so I could not put in any victims' photos. I have never tried so hard to find victims' photos so that I could, you know, they need to be remembered, and I like to pay a tribute to victims because that's why I write these books. That's why this genre exists. But the parents were so dead set against it, they felt that somebody else should not be making money off their daughter's stories. And I totally understand and respect their right to feel that way, but that's not what I'm trying to do. I really was trying to pay a tribute to their daughter, so I wasn't able to use any photos of their daughters. And because this case never went to court, there were no crime scene photos that were ever released into the court process because there really was no court process. Mm-hmm. So what I had to do was, and thankfully, you know, in this town I have worked as a journalist for many, many years, and I've gotten to know, you know, various producers at TV stations. What I did was I used news footage, still shots from Channel 10 and Channel 8, you know, CBS and ABC affiliates, kind of partnered with me, so I was able to kind of recreate crime scene photos by using news photos, and I really thank them for you know, helping me out with that. I took some of my own photos, and I was able to get some photos from John Gardner's family for, you know, him when he was young, and so that, you know, I just pieced it together essentially that way.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Caitlin Rother. The book is Lost Girls. God, there's just, it's just so heartbreaking. It's hard to read. I lost my train of thought here for 5 seconds, but tell me about whether there is a particular structure for true crime. If true crime, I know it's a genre, mm-hmm. Is there sort of, I don't want to say a formula, but is there sort of a structure that you are given by the genre that you follow? Because the book has this incredibly great back and forth, you know, John's childhood, kind of intermixed with, you know, what happened on that day with, you mm-hmm. know, kind of flashbacks into what happened with him.
Well, thank you.
Is there, yeah, it flows so nicely, and one of the things that I think would be very difficult about true crime is that it's hard to get in a lot of different textures. You know, in a novel, mm-hmm. you can have a bit of humor, you can mm-hmm. balance things, and I would think in true crime it's more difficult to obtain that balance, but this really does achieve that. Was there sort of a structure that you were able to follow from the genre itself, or is this organic and your own?
More of the latter, I think. I teach narrative nonfiction, and so I've really been able to kind of analyze and step back when I'm putting together the structure for a book, and I think that every story is, you know, calls out its own need for a different structure sometimes. I mean, in general, the genre is, you know, you've got the murder, you've got the background of the killer and the victims, you've got the investigation, and you've got the trial. Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, like I said, there was no trial. So right away, the structure is going to be different. So I thought, okay, what do I want to include in this book? I did all those original things that I mentioned, but what I was able to do instead of the trial was, let's look at the system. Let's look at the flaws in the system, and let's explore because there were a lot of probes and investigations that came out of this case, you know, in Sacramento, in terms of the correction system, the mental health system, the parole system. A lot of things broke down. So right. I was able to, you know, be an investigative reporter and go into some of these issues in a way that I would have if I were still at the newspaper and had, you know, as much room as you have in the book to write, you know, entire chapters instead of tiny little short stories to really explore some of these issues. And then I was also able to, you know, talk about reactions in the community and within, you know, the victims' families, because they spoke to the media so much, I was able to just take their stories using their own words, you know, on TV and tell their stories in this book without interviewing them and still feel like I was completely accurately representing, you know, their, as if they had talked to me directly, because I was using their words, not reporter summaries or interpretations of their words, but their words.
Right.
And basically, what do people want to know, and what do I think is important for people to know? And then I, even though we know how this ends, you know, there's a lot of exclusive and new information in here about how they found Amber's remains. What was the story behind John Gardner's leading the authorities to the body? How did that come about? Mm-hmm. You know, how did they get him out of the jail? Where, you know, he led them. He, you know, what was the conversation? So I'm basically create a story arc where I give you new information so that all the way along you're getting things that are new that you haven't read in the media, that go behind the scenes in the investigation, that go behind the scenes. You know, and in this case also with law enforcement, I really thought it was interesting that the law enforcement was so emotional with this case.
Right,
and I really wanted to show that too, that they're human beings as well, because they got emotional and disappointed and heartbroken when they found Chelsea's body. I mean, I thought that was really touching, you know, and the woman who was a forensic anthropologist and how she picked up Amber's skull in her hands and cradled it so it wouldn't be in the dirt anymore. You know, I mean, I cried when I heard that, and I wanted people who read that book to feel that moment where she was thinking about her own 14-year-old daughter and how, you know, horrible this must have been for Amber's parents to not know where she was for the past year. I look for those emotional moments, and I make basically a timeline and a story arc based on those key moments all the way through the victims' childhoods and lives, the killers' lives, the investigation, and, you know, all the way through. And then I try to bring some kind of positive resolution. That's become much more important to me as I've been writing these books. You know, in the beginning, it was just exciting to be writing a book, which is something I had always dreamed of doing. But in order to maintain this life as a full-time author in this genre, I've really had to find ways to make something positive out of something so horrible, or I would be living all my time in the darkness, and
yeah.
I can't be there. So I don't want the reader to feel like that when they're done. I want them to finish the book with feeling like they learned something, feeling like at least there's some hope, and not just this heavy, horrible, sick feeling about our sick society with, you know, nothing that they could do about it.
Right, right. It's obvious where your journalistic background plays into the novel, or plays into the book writing, because it's a direct correlation. Was it difficult for you to go from a shorter genre, I mean, newspapers are so incredibly strict about word count and brevity, to a longer form? Was that a big transition for you?
Well, it actually, I made the transition partly while I was still at the paper. I was a narrative writer at the paper, so I would write very long stories, in-depth in this similar style in the newspaper.
Okay.
So I started by, you know, I was writing a novel at home, and I worked with a writing coach who helped me, you know, find my voice, essentially, that I was, you know, an investigative reporter writing news stories, but I was also a pretty good feature writer, and I was able to move from that into narrative writing in the shorter form, you know, 100 inches or whatever in the newspaper, to, you know, this book form, which is really long, and then learning how to structure a book. I mean, I kind of just, you know, I sort of diagrammed, you know, other books and tried to picture a story arc and use suspense all the way through. So I learned some of those techniques at the newspaper, but, you know, I just read a lot of books and tried to study study good book writing and storytelling.
Yeah. Did the manuscript go out to anybody involved in the case to get their take on it before it was published, just to make sure that, I don't know if you vet manuscripts with people, it seems like you wouldn't, but did you show this to John Gardner's family or?
You know, I offered his mother a chance to read the chapters that were written based on her, you know, on the interviews that we did, because we talked for 4 months, like, you know, twice a week, and I sat with her a few times for, you know, 3 to 5 hours at a time. And when it's something so personal, I mean, I really wanted to give her a chance, and she couldn't deal with it. She just didn't want to. This is a very difficult thing for her to go through, and to be interviewed about it. She was having nightmares, and it was just so personal. And, you know, her family didn't come out of this looking so great. You know, it's a dysfunctional family. It's embarrassing, right?
Right.
And she just, I don't think she could face it. So on occasion, I do offer that to some people, especially if they're worried about, you know, accuracy or how they're going to look. I will read things to people over the phone and do fact-checking.
Uh-huh.
So it sort of depends. But, yeah, I have sent pages and chapters to various people who I've written about, but I don't send the entire book to anybody because I think that wouldn't be a good idea.
Right, yeah, right.
You don't want an electronic version floating around
right.
out there.
Right, right. Do publishers come to you with book contracts of things they want written about? Do you do it that way as well?
Not so far. I have an agent, and I have, it's kind of, I do co-author books, so what happens sometimes is my first agent, who works in partnership with my current agent, she may have a first-time author who will come to her with a great story but doesn't know how to write it,
mm-hmm.
And they, you know, sometimes team us up.
Sort of a not really ghostwriting, but sort of a ghostwriting, co-authoring.
I don't ghostwrite, and I tell them that right up front. I say I'm a co-author, so I need to have cover credit. And depending on, you know, how much experience you've had as a writer, I will help you shape it. But most of the time, they don't know what narrative is. They don't know how to write it. They don't know how to do interviews. They don't do the interviews. So in some cases, I do all the interviews. I do the writing, or I'll do the rewriting. I'll interview them to get their voice and write it in their voice, and, you know, try to use their words as much as possible. But it sort of varies from book to book on the situation. But I do that, and those end up paying more than these true crime books, because I can't make a living on these true crime books. They just don't pay.
Right.
And I know everybody thinks that someone who has 8 books must be making a ton of money, but they should look at my 1997 Honda CRV if that's what they think. With the doors.
Yeah. The issue of that's hilarious. The issue of voice is an interesting one, because it is, I mean, this very much was from somebody else's, you know, from the people's voices, and I assume
right.
that in true crime that's always the case. So it would be interesting to find the unique voice for each one of these books that is often probably not your voice.
Yeah, I guess some of the chapters are going to be in my voice when they're more objective and, you know, the omniscient point of view. But like I said, I do tend to write scenes from one of the characters' points of view, because that gets you into their head.
Yeah.
But it really does vary. I mean, I have written and co-authored books where I'm really trying to, you know, be respectful to the primary author's voice, because it's his story, like My Life Deleted.
Mm-hmm.
So it just really kind of, just depends on the book. And My Life Deleted, by the way, is not a true crime book. It's a memoir. So
right.
I write and co-write memoirs as well. And so some of these true crime books are true crime / memoirs, and My Life Deleted is just a straight memoir.
Right, right.
So I use the memoir techniques also in writing some of these books and the story arcs as well.
Right. I can't believe we drew down on our time. I thought an hour we'll be able to cover everything, and, you know, we'll have time left over, and I still have 30 questions, even though I'm
Well, I can come back another time. You can ask me the rest later.
That would be fantastic. That would be fantastic. And I know there's going to be another book, I'm sure. Well, I know there is, because you're working on it now. Do you know when is due out about the femme fatale here in Orange County?
Yes. My first deadline is actually in about a week or two, and I'll be finishing that one up in a few months. And I'm hoping to get that one out sooner rather than later, but it usually takes a little bit less than a year to get a book out.
Okay.
So hopefully by the end of 2013.
I'm looking forward to that one. Yeah, anything...
It's a good one. This one is really interesting. Nanette Packard, I like to write about female killers if I can because they're so rare.
Right,
And it's so interesting to me because men are the ones who tend to be violent, right? But in this case, I mean, she didn't do it, right? She was convicted of conspiring and manipulating and getting someone else to kill her lover for her, right?
Yeah,
so she
right.
could get the money and that he could get the money, they could share it, which he denies still to this day. Eric Napofsky says there's a hitman out there who is the one who actually pulled the trigger. But Nanette is just a piece of work. I have never in my entire career written about somebody who was such an incredible liar and manipulator and so greedy. Oh, my God, I just cannot believe the extent of this woman's greed. It's incredible. And I've finally been getting some information about her younger years, which nobody else has been able to get. So I'm going to have a lot of really good exclusive information that people can learn things. They're going to say, oh, I already know everything there is to know. And then they'll read my book and say, oh, wow.
No, I didn't.
That's always my goal.
Caitlin Rother, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That was Caitlin Rother. The book is Lost Girls. You can find her at her website, caitlinrother.com, C-A-I-T-L-I-N, Rother, R-O-T-H-E-R.com. You can follow her on Twitter. You can follow her on Facebook. Facebook at Caitlin Rother on Twitter is where she is. crother@flash.net is a place where you can email her if you have more questions for her. This show will be up and available via podcast in the next couple of weeks. I appreciate you joining us. We are out of time. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9. Stay tuned for Sister Rue coming up with a little bit of reggae for your morning with positive vibrations coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Have a great day.